Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Welcome to another edition of the Chicago Way with John Cass and Jeff Carlin. And our guest, again, as usual, like our little sister, Kristen McQuarrie from the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune.
Yes, hello.
Hey, sis.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder what it would be. Did you have brothers?
I did not. Two sisters. I'm the middle.
See, you would be like the little. Actually, you could be like my kid, not my sister. But you could, it would be nice to have a sister in my life, and I didn't have one.
You didn't? You just had a brother?
Two brothers,
Two
yeah.
brothers. Okay.
You know, to make s'mores with. And
sure.
You could tell me, you know, how to talk to girls and
right.
stuff.
You'd be more sensitive in life in general if you had a sister.
Speaking of which, there's another old-style convention called Father's Day.
Yes.
For men.
Yes.
We have kids, right?
What are you doing for Father's Day?
I think I want to have dinner at 2 o'clock like a Protestant
this
family.
That's what you say every holiday.
That's what I want. When I was a kid growing up, immigrant kid, you know, wild ethnic family, I wanted to eat like a Protestant in the movies. No offense, my Protestant friends, okay? But 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you wear a cardigan, you talk to your wife, you say, Mother.
Yes, you drink out of a little cordial.
And you can hear the clicking of the silverware on the
sure.
plate. No one talks.
What would be served? Like a full turkey dinner or?
What are you going to do for Father's Day, Kristen?
Oh, I'm behind. I keep forgetting it's coming up. I have nothing. I have nothing for my husband. I have nothing for my father. So
you are so bad.
I know.
A man can just run after the, get off the train, and there's usually some vulture, right, Jeff,
mm-hmm.
who swoops in on you to offer you a dozen roses for $250 cash.
Right. Exactly.
Right? And there you go. You say.
No markup.
No markup. And you go, okay, here. And then you bring them home, and your wife's like, or your mom for Mother's Day.
Mm.
Hi, honey. Thank you.
Right.
Real easy.
Mm-hmm.
For women, it's harder.
It is harder. I don't have
or
any.
Or more difficult.
Oh, yeah. Your options are like socks. There's a guy trying to sell you socks for Father's Day. You know,
well,
so,
on
yeah.
the Dan Ryan, that's every day.
Well, right.
When
but
I get
the, but the,
socks,
the savvy
water.
Ones. The savvy
oh.
ones are like, Father's Day, socks for your dad. You know.
It'd why be so dad... funny if I shopped for my husband at the Dan Ryan interchange.
You know why? You know why dads need socks for Father's Day? If they have sons? Because their sons come into the bedroom when they're not there and grab the long socks.
Yeah.
So now I have black socks that I don't wear suits every day like I used to, but black socks that are like ankle-y socks.
Yes.
That's not good for a
no,
suit.
No.
You look like some old alderman on a one of those interview shows, you know,
yes.
with the socks
mm-hmm.
showing.
How do you feel like about the sockless look? The loafers that, you know, like the skinny like, pant that I keep seeing all the
boat shoe with the no socks.
Yes.
Yeah, no. It's very European. I don't approve.
It's not European. It's American, based in the, you know, 60s, in the sort of Yale-y, Kennedy, let's go, you know, on a little sailing trip.
Yeah,
yeah, but
I guess.
But in Europe, nobody wears socks.
Like, they don't.
They're expensive.
Sandals.
Right, expensive. Cotton was very expensive in Europe for a long time.
I don't want to see your ankles, Jeff Carlin, or John Cass. Put some socks on those.
All right, so what is Kristen going to get her husband for Father's Day?
You know, we're pretty, we don't really go all out. Like Mother's Day, we'll have a home-cooked meal or he'll grill or something. So I'm thinking I'll just, you know, be really sweet and nice all day, and we're going to get together with
as opposed to
every other day.
You're going to let him, give him the remote control. That's the first thing.
Okay, I'll
a
do that.
A six-pack of beer is the second
All right,
thing.
I Cam's can do
the
that,
beer
too.
Refreshing.
Oh, he likes craft beer.
Okay.
He's a craft beer.
Maple, Charlatan Pale Ale from Maplewood Breweries.
Okay.
Is that your go-to, John?
That's my go-to. Actually, it's my... We're in-laws, the two guys, Ari and Paul, two mm-hmm. brothers, Miguelis brothers. They started this brewery right near Scott Wagspeck's place.
Oh.
And I don't like the whole crap. Like, I have to have craft beer. I always think it's like, you know, shut up, okay? Drink a beer. Open the can, drink it. So I was at a party, and some guy, unrelated, guy's like, try this beer. I'm like, man, this is good. And it's those guys.
Well, so see, now you're on board. What is it called again?
Can I say it without having to pay for it? It's Maplewood Breweries, Charlatan Pale Ale.
Very Trumpian.
Naughty.
Ah,
but, you know,
I see.
But you can't if you can't do that. What about the main gifts?
I don't have any. I have no main gifts. How about if I just give
polo
him
polo shirt?
No. I could do the polo shirt. He has been complaining that he hasn't had a chance to golf at all this year. And he only golfs maybe once or twice a year. So I was thinking maybe I'll just, you know, set aside a day and arrange for him to go golfing. Would that be good enough?
One day?
Yeah, just
for
one
a guy
day.
That likes golfing? How yeah. about like a series of days where you take care of the kids and where you don't give them that look like, you know.
The
like,
one that I'm giving you right now.
No, not the mean look. Not the mean wife look, but the sad wife you look like. Mm-hmm. Don't you want to be with your children? Which is even worse. And you say, look, on these next 3 weekends, you're golfing, my friend.
Three? I have to do three? I'm just suggesting
one. You gotta get
one.
Your swing down, right, Jeff?
Sure, John. You're the golf fanatic, right?
Yeah.
What's your stance on golf? You kind of got into it earlier, but I didn't.
I hate golf. I'll never golf. Golfing for me is for rich judges who wear those big plaid pants like Tom Hines at the Beverly Country Club. You know, the big plaid with
do.
The blue
the
blazer?
The wide plaid, yeah.
The wide plaid, yeah. Uh-uh.
No. You have never golfed.
Never golfed?
Have you ever never. Swung a club? Have you?
Yeah, I have. Mm-hmm. Besides at Western Trails.
Okay.
I don't know if it's still alive. The mini. No, I don't. Arnold Palmer won Athlete of the Decade when I was like, I don't know, 10. And he beat out Gale Sayers, Bobby Hull, Johnny Unitas, all these great athletes, Muhammad Ali. He beat all the great athletes. He was the great athlete of the decade. So I realized that golf is like to sport what, what's those shows where the singers come on and people vote for them?
Like The Voice.
Like The Voice mm-hmm. and all that. To actual art.
Okay.
It's all marketing and nonsense.
Hmm.
So stay away from golf. Go fish. Do you like fishing?
I don't golf. I have never golfed. I try to swing.
True,
I find
liberal
it just
Democrat.
A very I find swinging a golf club just to be counterintuitive. It's very awkward. Maybe just because I don't do it often enough. I don't like to fish either. I'm not going to lie. I'm kind of squeamish.
Fishing.
Kind of squeamish about the worms.
You don't use worms.
And then I feel sorry
fishing.
For them. Then I feel bad for them when they come out. I just want to throw them. I want everybody to throw their fish back
in
the water.
Does it make that sound like?
They die right in front of you.
You can't see my face.
That's like the worst.
They are creatures
the worst
of God.
Possible death. I can see your face. Yeah, John is doing a very good fish impersonation.
Very good. Yeah. Like a scared fish.
Very scared fish.
Do you fish, either of you?
Yeah.
Here's my stance on both. I enjoy the camaraderie of being out in the public, you know, being out in nature to doing something fun and drinking beer or Bloody Marys. But the golfing is secondary and the fishing is secondary. I've got a fishing pole and a tackle box. I've got a golf set and, you know, golf glove. But I'd rather just hang out and drink.
I'm with you.
I'm the jester that comes along and just wants to tell stories and
drive the golf cart.
Yeah,
I'll do
that.
I'll do that.
I do have a story where a friend of mine. I used to brew craft beer with a friend of mine, and we had a golf outing, and so I brought a third golf bag with a pony keg full of our homemade beer.
Nice.
Yeah. So we had two our golf clubs, and then that golf bag. So we had three bags in our cart, and a little hose holding over, and we're pouring, handing out to everybody, and needless to say, we were intoxicated, but we tried to make a golf cart go faster. I don't know if there's like a limiter so you can reach in, and if you know how to do it.
Oh no.
Yeah, unfortunately the limiter is usually right next to the exhaust pipe, and so I did burn myself a couple times, but I had been drinking so I didn't feel it.
Right.
So, but that was one of my best golf experiences, so if that tells you anything about of a golfer I am, that's it.
I love it. It's very anti-country club. I'm sure the country club loved seeing you with your red solo cup, you know, on the course.
Don't the Fire have a game on
I don't know.
To the Fire, Toyota Park, I think. I don't know. Colorado Rapids.
Okay. You have season tickets,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That's an option. Mm-hmm.
You also go to a Sox game if they're playing. I'm sure you could get tickets.
I can't go to Sox games anymore. I love the Sox. I watch them on TV. It's just making me sick, okay? It's making me sick. It's like saying the words Miss Schlapia to me. me.
Excuse me?
Ms. Schlapia was my first grade teacher.
It's like, what is
And she was so mean.
Sounded like a body part.
Yeah, that was.
I remember she asked all the kids in school, first grade at Sherman School on 52nd and Morgan. She asked all the kids what they had for dinner, right? And everyone's like, corned beef and cabbage. And then comes to me, John, what did you have for dinner? And I looked in the face of evil right there because I knew she knew I didn't eat corned beef and cabbage. Not that I don't like it. I like it very much. We just didn't have it that day. And I said, pasticcio. And she said, what? Pasticcio? And I you know how when you're a little kid, you kind of cringe?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you're making me out to be this different, weird person.
Yes.
I just want to fit in. Miss Schlapia. I hate you, Miss Schlapia.
Oh, goodness.
I hate her.
That kind of relates to your column a little bit today.
So if anybody
hasn't read John Cass on Wednesday, please do, because it's a very...
There'll be plenty of columns to read. And let me ask you this. What are you going to get your husband? Dang it.
I don't know.
Do
I
something.
Don't know. I don't know. It's coming.
All right. What do you want to get him?
I would like to arrange for him to golf. I would, because it's not like he coaches two of my son's baseball teams. He's really busy doing stuff every weekend with us and with the kids. And so I would be absolutely fine with him taking a couple days. I was just going to do a day, but now you're telling me three. So
three, because you have to go to the first day, then you have to
warm
totally
up,
suck the second time.
Right.
And the third time, try to get
vindication. And you have to find somebody to go with him, because you can't golf alone.
Yeah.
They won't let you do it.
You want to
golf
with your wife, though?
No.
I don't think so.
No,
you
I don't want to golf
time,
with him.
Daddy time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll arrange for friend or
that's golfing is like burping and scratching time.
Really? See, I have this
Thanks
country club impression.
Picture.
Well, I mean,
that's more VFW hall. I'm thinking country club.
Fried perch, all you can eat.
Exactly. Have you seen this? They do now. They have the Segway golf carts. Have you seen like individual golf carts? Oh my God, they're amazing.
Can you drink while you're on
absolutely.
It sounds dangerous.
It is dangerous. But in my experience, I'm assuming it's less dangerous than a golf cart, because I told my story. But they
Two wheels?
Yeah, so it's two wheels. So you have, instead of a traditional four-wheel, you know, golf cart, it's like a Segway, and it's a little more stable, but it's got a little thing for your golf bag on the front, and then you just cruise around the golf cart. It's got a little bit bigger wheels, I think, than a traditional golf cart.
So you lean forward, and if you've had, like, four gin and tonics, you're really leaning forward.
Well, you have to hold on, yes. But the beauty is
there's probably a cup holder.
Right, there's definitely a cup mm-hmm. holder, and the Segway is so smart that it can balance for you.
Wow.
Put my big fed Greek ass on a four-wheeled contraption, okay? So I can sit down. Because that's what golfing is, drinking. But that doesn't, Kristen, that doesn't count as the gift of Father's
Day. Okay, so you're
Day.
Saying I need like a something.
Something to
tangible,
hand.
Something
yeah.
to hand
Not
him.
Not just, oh, honey, go golfing.
Oh, gosh. All right, I'll think of something. I'll report back
how
next
about,
week and tell
about
you
how about two turtle doves in a cage?
No.
Now, what do you think, Jeff?
What do you do with two turtle doves? I'm confused.
They just let them coo while you're watching. What else could you give, Jeff, for Father's Day?
Well, for Father's Day, my brother and I are going to take my dad to, we did this last year, he really enjoys it, but we're going to take him to Bears training camp.
Oh,
that's
fun.
Get up early, cruise down, have brunch. Yeah.
Can you open Bears training camp on June 6th?
Well, no.
No, okay, so that's nice. So that's a thing you're going to do. What do you give him in his hand?
Yeah, so you got to, John Cass has a rule, you have to have something to
yeah,
wrap up.
Not just like a little script like my kids did. Like, Mom, I love you. I'll make breakfast. Like, really, you ever did? You know, trying to get those
the little
guys,
coupons that you never cash
yeah,
in.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
There you go.
So, what are you going to give, guys? You have to hand something.
All right, I'll think of something.
Now you've got me nervous, John.
I might do the fallback polo shirt.
Yeah, shoot. My dad doesn't even wear polo shirts.
All right. How about this? I got one polo shirt with a bottle of Old Spice aftershave.
Oh God.
My dad's more of a brute guy, but you're
awful.
Right.
High karate.
No way.
Old Spice, it's back now. It's now cool. Cause
it is?
It used
is.
To be like old-timey.
No, it is.
Now it's because they market it with like some head sticking out of some ball player's shoulder.
Terry, whatever his face is, the big muscle guy who flexes pecs.
No steroids.
No steroids. But yeah, it's absolutely, it really is, because Kevin Powell, so John will mention this, but produced for Donna Roma. I used to produce for Donna Roma, for Ro and Anna, and our sports producer, or anchor rather, is Kevin Powell. And he's dyed-in-the-wool millennial. I mean, he's 26, 27.
He wears Old Spice.
He loves Old Spice.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding.
I kid you not. In fact, one day he comes into work, and he's like, I ran out of deodorant. I need to go across to Walgreens.
To get some Old Spice.
So we go over there, and I'm just walking with him, and he's like looking at all the options. He's like, oh, I got to get Old Spice. I'm like, Old Spice? I'm like, what's wrong with you? He's like, no, it's the best, I swear. He's like, I sweat a lot, and I got to put it on all the time. I'm like, I mean, it's not the best. I mean, it's not
the best. It is good. It used to be worn by merchant sailors named Vic.
Yeah.
Okay? And now, right? That's how they sold it in the old day. You wore your pea coat and you'd walk around and you'd whistle.
Yes. I remember commercials like
that.
Used
to come in that ceramic bottle.
Have you seen some of the perfumes they sell at Walgreens, though? You can get dirt. What? Honestly, it smells like dirt or garden tomato.
Yeah.
Gin and tonic is one of them. They're all these different scents that
mulch.
I don't think you're
for
supposed
ladies to wear.
Well, I don't think you're supposed to put them on your body. I think you can create like a candle or a little scent for your bathroom or something like that.
No, you put them on your body.
You do. You can put them on your body.
They used to sell them over here. Courtney Flynn, one of my old leg persons.
I remember,
remember Courtney?
Mm-hmm.
She's awesome. She said, you got to go over here. I went over to Nordstrom's and they were selling it there. And now it's at Walgreens?
Yes. Ooh, the Walgreens across the street here on Michigan.
How have we fallen
there's
from
maybe
Nordstrom's
40
to
different. 40 different just oddball
grease pit,
you know, selection.
I'm thinking of like lamb poop for
right.
You know,
there are some growth. I mean, there are some that are I would describe as
bourbon
kind of
barrel.
Gross.
That would do it for me.
What would
bourbon barrel?
Put that behind your ears, honey.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. Well, before we let Chris go back to,
just got to go to the real world.
Right. We want to talk a little about LitFest because for John and I was late, and John will rag me about this. It was a lot of fun, and for those who didn't make it, your loss. Although it was really hot and sweaty in that tent until they opened the flaps.
We had a lot of people there. Jeff,
right.
Jeff comes in late.
So he walks
so
in
I'm
back.
Doing, I have to do the whole thing like, hello, everyone, blah, blah, blah. How are
you?
You
have to introduce yourself.
Telling jokes and stuff. And here, and I'm waiting for Jeff because I'm thinking, get here, plug your thing in so we have podcast sound.
Oh, right.
Right. And the best part was that John, we go through the hour, it's up, and John's like, all right, you know, I got to go. I'm going to go get some fresh air, which means if you don't like smoke, then stay away from me. And John walks out, and he walks to, you know, off the side from the tent we were in. We're standing around. Literally, John's like leaning on a garbage can smoking a cigarette.
Because it was shade.
Right, it was shady, and that was the beauty of it. And John thinking about it, his fans. But held court for at least a good 45 minutes to an hour.
Really?
And there were, at the onset, probably 25, 30 people maybe who just kind of standing around you. And then by the end, there were probably 10 people still, but people kept coming up.
And I kept talking like, wait, don't leave. I got something else to say. Wait.
But everybody wanted to get John's idea on everything. I mean, you name it. They wanted to get his take on it. And even some people came up to me and gave me, and they're like, hey, can I get a picture? And I'm like, what the? What?
Yeah.
I'm like, that's weird.
That is
great. Cool.
That kid that from U of I that's been reading since he was a sophomore in high school.
Wow.
Some kids, I think there were some kids from Leo. I mean, they're just
wonderful. Wonderful. That's a great event.
I thank you, John, for inviting me. And I apologize again for my underwhelming.
You were Greek time there. You were half.
And Mrs.
Greek
Cass went.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Mrs.
Lovely.
Cass went, and she had to do the whole, Rob, what do I wear before we, you know, we went out. And she looked really good, and people liked meeting her.
Yes.
Great.
She was nice. And she told me that, when we're talking, she starts doing the wifely silent talk thing, you know, where you're talking to the husband, but
yes.
I know what you're saying, but you're shouting.
So you can see her in the audience?
I can see her lips.
Okay.
It was like, read her lips. And she says, John, don't interrupt. Stop interrupting Jeff.
And she looks at me and she's like apologizing for her. She's like, I don't know why he does that. He's just like, she's not saying anything, but she is saying that. She's like, I'm like, oh, yeah, it's okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's what wives do. I remember when I guest hosted with you on a different radio station once, and there was a possibility.
Oh, the one that fired me?
Yeah. There was a possibility that you were going to have to give me a ride from the station to the tower.
Yeah.
And your wife had been worried that morning because your car is full of newspapers and empty coffee cups.
And
she said, make sure you clean your car if you're giving her a ride. So that is.
There's probably Janssen wrappers from, you know, 6 months before.
Yes, yes. So that's what wives do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a little clip here. Got a little serious, but John was talking about, you know, people asking about the state and the politics. And this is something that I thought was really interesting because you talked about the poor state of our state, the way it is and people leaving.
My son said to me, the one that wants to be an accountant and studying finance at IU, he said, Dad, I don't think I'm coming back to Chicago after college. I'm like, really? It's $45,000 a year, sir. You're not going to come back? You know? What kind of investment is that, right? And he said, because there's no opportunity. And I'm thinking, as an immigrant son, my kids don't know this because they grew up in the suburbs, but I mean, I have known people who were peddlers, okay? My father-in-law was a window washer and made a living and built something, right? My uncles and cousins, they peddled. You know the guy with the knife, you know, the knife sharpener guy? I saw him the other day on my block. I'm like, my God. Okay, people could do anything. They would come here with nothing. Nothing. White privilege? What the hell are you talking about? Greeks weren't white. Italians weren't white. Poles weren't white. I don't know who was white back then. I don't know what they're talking about. And if there's no opportunity, everyone goes. They go where there's opportunity, especially the most dynamic of us, right? The ones that have that risk will take that risk. They're the ones you need to build a country and build a state. So, yeah, it's a war. And that's why I call him the White Walker, because I love Game of Thrones. My wife does not. I do. And he's the White Walker. Whether he's good or evil, whether he's right or wrong, no matter what he is now, that's what the army is. That's what it is. And if you don't stop it, we're done.
Whoa, sure, Mr. Heavy.
And I hate to bring it down on that, but that was really the essence of kind of what happened and what John talked about. It was a great thing. So,
well, you know, I just basically read Christian columns and change my mind. But we are in a serious problem now, Christian. And I'm in the column. I'm going to be taking a more activist view, even though there are good Democrats that I like in the state, Will Guzzardi, other people that are seemingly decent, even though I disagree with their policies and their politics. I think they're decent people, but a vote for a Democrat now to me is a vote for Mike Madigan or for John Cullerton, and the state cannot afford. That's my view.
I think personal view. Sure, and I think that is finally resonating with people. I think when Mike Madigan's House passed a budget that was $7 billion out of balance, and we've talked about the exchange of between his majority leader and a downstate lawmaker who was questioning money. I think people are finally willing to make that separation and say, I like my local lawmaker who is a Democrat, but yes, a vote for a Democrat, even one that you like, is a vote for Madigan. I don't know whether Republicans will be able to pick up any seats. Last time around, they picked up one in the Senate, one seat. The cycle before that, the Democrats cemented their supermajority status, right, in 2012.
And the one before that is the one that they had a chance to do something, but there was no rounder on the scene. The Republicans were basically combine suck-ups, and it was done.
So I don't have, you know, I think Republicans will view a victory if they even just pick up maybe two seats in the House, one in the Senate. That's probably what we're looking at. And even under that scenario, Madigan still maintains his majority.
If he does, here's what's going to happen. If Mike Madigan keeps his majority and Cullerton keeps his majority, Cullerton D, DeLeo keeps his majority, what happens is people are going to leave. Simple. You're going to see stories, more people leaving the state.
Mm-hmm.
They're just already, I see in solid middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods in Cook County, a lot of homes for sale.
Yeah.
I'm seeing that. Papers haven't picked up on the trend yet, but you see it. That's because of the property tax that's coming.
Yes.
Cook County-wide and the one that's already coming in the city.
Yeah.
And more to come.
We're in trouble. There's no question about it.
Before I let you go, let me put this in your mind. Three golfings. Hi, honey. Just golf. That's okay, honey. And then polo shirt.
The beer. Remember it.
Mm-hmm. Hams. Or craft beer in your
right,
case.
Right, the maple, whatever.
And Old Spice.
Okay. And be nice all day.
What about dinner?
Be real sweet.
What about dinner? What does he like to eat?
Grill out. We'll grill out. He likes to
what are you
have
gonna
a
grill?
Steak. Probably steaks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
Happy Father's Day, Kristen.
Happy Father's Day to you, John Cass. Are you going to get to see both boys?
Yeah, both boys will be in.
Excellent. That's all you really need.
And
on
I might
Father's
have
Day.
Something to show you next week.
Okay.
All right.
Great. The cats in the cradle and the suit. Good.
this weekend. I think everyone was stunned and terrified, sickened by what happened in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub with the madman or with the self-hating gay guy or whether he's an Islamic terrorist or all these things. As everyone's picking up our rocks now and we're throwing our rocks at each other in this political season. 49 people dead, and he died himself. And a fascinating story from Poynter Institute, how the Orlando Sentinel, with a third of its staff it once had, covered the country's deadliest mass shooting. This is a story by Kristen Hare, and it's just an amazing story about a news organization that's basically half of what it once was, and how they scrambled to provide what I thought to be the go-to and excellent coverage every way on this terrible and fast-breaking story. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning. Hi.
So tell us, how does a news organization like the Sentinel deal with all these cuts and then come back so strong?
So, you know, that's really what the heart of the story is kind of seeking to answer. And I have to be honest, I didn't know that was what I was looking for when I got there. I got up like everybody else on Sunday morning and saw this. I actually saw it from a journalism professor in Orlando that I follow on Instagram and, you know, turned on my television. And one of the things that I have learned, I used to be a reporter in St. Louis, and I covered Ferguson for Poynter, and the journalists there. One of the things that I have, I think, an appreciation for is that when something happens in most parts of the world, the first place you should go is to the local media. They're the closest to the ground. They have the sources. They're the ones listening to the scanners. This is true, I think, in St. Louis in the beginning, and this was definitely true in Orlando. So I, you know, in my pajamas on my couch on Sunday morning, quickly made a Twitter list of all of the journalists in Orlando. And what I noticed right away was there were a couple journalists from the Sentinel who were there all night. Most journalists who were covering it ended up being there all night, but they were there fast. And they were using Periscope. They were on Twitter. They were, you know, live streaming what was happening as it unfolded. And so you could really see what we understood in those very early hours unfold. And they were sort of just putting it all out there. So by, you know, 3 o'clock on Sunday, we had gotten the okay from the editors at the Sentinel for me to come in and just be a fly on the wall. And I was, you know, it's not surprising that a newsroom fills up when a giant thing happens. So this was no different on a Sunday. It was full of people. But, you know, they just finished covering a horrific murder of a singer on Friday night. And just watching this group, this small group of people churn and churn and churn, kind of led to some questions that finally got me to the heart of the story. And that was, I was talking with one of the local news editors, and I asked the question that, you know, most journalists ask at the end of an interview, which is, what am I forgetting? What have I not asked? Right. And one I like to add in for journalists when I'm interviewing journalists is, what do you think this story is about? How would you write this if you were me? And Lisa Chanchi, the local news editor, said, you know, one of my biggest fears was that we were going to be so small that we wouldn't be able to handle ourselves. And this has been, you know, kind of our biggest fire drill. And I've seen now that we can do it. So, you know, from there, I just went back and started getting details about the size of the news organization, what it used to be. And you can see the resilience and the determination that, you know, all newsrooms have, whether you have 350 people or whether you're down to 100, you know, this drive to inform people of what's happening, especially when you're the local source. It still exists.
Kristen, can you talk a little bit about that number change? I mean, what were they dealing with? How many people do they have on working in a newsroom who were expected to be there?
They currently have 100. Editors weren't positive. They thought maybe it's 108, maybe. So we stuck to just about 100 in the newsroom. When I was there, I mean, the number of people I could see in the newsroom itself was probably maybe around 20 bodies, you know, sitting at their desks. But then there are probably twice that many out reporting and filing and calling in. And so, you know, the situation that they're in, though, and this is kind of where I tried to end the story, is so they've been churning, they've been doing this, you know, last night, all of the reporters who've been covering the Orlando shooting are now covering this horrific case of this alligator that grabbed this toddler at, you know, a Disney hotel. And it's the same people who have been covering the shooting. So, you know, these are people who I think are going to need some TLC and some time off, but they don't really have time for that yet. I do understand that a couple of the reporters who have been on it since the weekend are off today officially, and I'm happy to hear that. I hope they are able to get some sleep.
One of the things about local coverage in a newspaper is you go to a local news site, a newspaper site, a broadcast team might have four reporters, even down mm-hmm. to 150. I guarantee you most of those people were involved somewhere or another. And mm-hmm. what I loved about your story in Pointer, and you can read it, guys, if you just go to pointer.org and look for Kristen's story on this Orlando, you just Google it, find it. The mm-hmm. way, the nature of reporters who come in, they hear something, and then they come into the office. They hear something's up, and then they start trickling in, and they start rushing in. And then there's that meeting. And then the managing editor, the metro editor, holds the meeting, and everyone's ready, and they just go running. They go running out.
Yeah, and this was interesting. They had, editors told me, they would get, you know, texts and calls from reporters who were not working, who were just showed up on different scenes. I mean, they just... Yeah. They self-sorted and they figured it out amongst themselves, which, you know, there's something to be said for having a huge, robust news organization. There's something to be said for having one that's nimble and has less layers to get through in these kinds of situations. And I think that that worked here.
You've worked for many.
You've
worked for years in the newspaper business. I'd like to ask you, based on my experience, there's always like a cadre. When mm-hmm. the stuff hits the fan, there's a cadre of reporters that an editor calls upon. You have your cop reporters, you have a feature writer, mm-hmm. you have all that. But there's a cadre on any mm-hmm. big story. And then for something like this, everybody starts pitching in. And it's like, it's hard to talk about it at the time, because really what you're focused on is the terrible loss of life and the suffering that people are going through. But there's a certain sense of, there's like a great sense of pride in a newspaper when they're doing that stuff.
Yeah, I talked to a developer, and this was another story that I wrote, a short story on Sunday night, and he came in, you know, I was sitting in a little, you know, empty office, and finding people as I could, and he came in and sat down and talked to me. And he said, I never thought I would live this day twice. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, you know, he was an intern at the Denver Post during the Aurora shooting. Mm. And he had built an interactive timeline for that. He built an interactive timeline for the Sentinel for this. But he had, you know, made offers. He wanted to write a profile if he could. They wrote profiles on all 49 of the victims. And I think they're, you know, it's hard not to romanticize our profession, but for all of the things that we have to deal with, including, you know, downsizing and what's generally pretty poor pay, and then, you know, not a lot of love from the public. I think a lot of journalists feel called to do this. And when something horrible happens, you just, you know, acting in the way that we're trained to act and mobilizing is the thing we do. I mean, I know I felt I was going out of my skin on Sunday just kind of watching this and knowing that, you know, I live in Tampa. This is an hour and a half away. And the minute we got the thumbs up to go to the newsroom, I was with my five-year-old at a pool party to celebrate preschool graduation. And just the other moms knew the situation and you know, watched me run out. And there's something satisfying about being able to get and share information when you otherwise feel helpless. And I think a lot of the journalists in Orlando and a lot of the journalists who've gone to Orlando from around the world, I think that's definitely a big motivator.
I'm also glad that you mentioned that some of the other Tribune Company papers, or Tribune Publishing, I can't still get that my mind around what they've done to us. Those TV people, what they've done. But everyone's pitched in and sent, you know, sources. Tribune Washington Bureau sent sources from the Justice Department. The Sun Sentinel sent reporters to the hometown. I mean, it's just like a lot of good coordination. And, yeah, we're not romanticizing it. But you know what? In terms terms of the business, I guarantee you there are news readers in broadcast who are looking at, following this stuff in, you know, what the Sentinel was putting out, and then just ripped it and read it as if they discovered it themselves, right? Was there a lot of...
You know, there's something very unglamorous about the work of print journalists, you know, and journalists who work in words online as well. But, you know, the Orlando Sentinel was to me another thing that I thought was pretty impressive. You know, I was there until after midnight on Sunday, and I asked just kind of offhand, they had so many videos, and I said, how many videos did you guys put up? And they did a quick count, and they said 30. In that one day, they'd produced 30 videos and 40 pieces online. And this wasn't, you know, these weren't aggregated blog posts. This wasn't, you know, quote unquote content, which journalists hate to hear what we do called. But
there were stories, real stories.
There were stories, and they were developing, and they were, you know, and they were on it. And so, you know, I think they did and have continued to sort of show what they're made of through this, and that is these traditional principles that guide all of us.
And Kristen, in your reporting and interviewing editors and staff down there, was there anything that they felt like, you know, if we had more people, we could do this, or if we were a little better staff, we'd be able to cover this piece of the story? Or do you think that the technology between Periscope and Twitter and the ability to upload stuff in an instant and get it back to, you know, newsroom, is that cover that? Or is there some other side of it that we're not seeing?
Yeah, it seems like it did. It seems like that was able to really, you know, journalists now know that they have to, you know, you're essentially a one-man band. You know, one of my favorite ways to think about what most of us have to do now is, I don't know if you guys remember Mary Poppins, but the Bert character, he walks around and he has, we're all, and that's what we do. We have the drums and we have the cymbals and, you know, we have the harmonica and it's all fixed. And those journalists have been trained, as have many, to be using social, to have all of the tools. They're creating videos. They're on Snapchat. They're doing all of those things. I do a lot of those things as well in my reporting when I'm out at the office. And one of the things that I've found is that it makes my reporting better, because suddenly I have video that I shot and I have all of these ways to go back and look at it, and it's not just buried in my notebook. I do think that the thing that would benefit them if they had more people is that everybody would be fresher. And, you know,
but they wouldn't come off the story. They would not come. I guarantee you, right? You've known this.
And they haven't. Yeah.
You don't come off the story. An editor says, okay, we'll have some downtime, right? I guarantee you, while that story's breaking, it could break for 36 hours. No journalist would ever want. They'd say, are you kidding? And then they'd start pouting, right? Like, you hate me? You don't like what I'm doing? Right? We'd freak out. We want to do
it. It's true. I think the danger in Orlando with now the third event in, you know, 3 or 4 days that would on its own make national and international news is that the same people, Crystal Hayes is the reporter who covered Christina Grimmie's murder on Friday night. She was, you know, went home on Saturday after her shift and went right back to Pulse when she heard what was happening. And then last night she was, you know, at this Disney hotel covering this alligator attack. So, I think it's all, it's great. I met her. She is somebody who seems very resilient. But I do think, like, for the long-term health of your newsroom, you got to be careful how you use your people, and that, you know, you don't run them ragged. So she does have the day off today. I'm happy to report. I don't know if she's working, though. She might be working.
She's probably writing a Sunday piece right now on both.
Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
One thing that concerns me, though, in the rush that we run out on breaking news and we're doing social media and we're putting stuff out independently, right, tweeting everything. Mm-hmm. Number one, you don't have an editor. You know, I guess I'm old-fashioned. I believe, you know, it's good to have that other eye on it. You know what I mean? Another eye.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is you're not, because you're sending stuff out from a small window, from a perspective of your eyes only.
Right.
I wonder if you miss the larger picture, but I think that's what good newsrooms have to deal with, right? They have to have the over and the and the macro and the on the ground look, right? But I worry about
that. I think it's a fair concern, and I think that journalists are getting better better since we've started using these tools about how we share things. But I also think our audience, like things, you know, when I first started, you know, I would write a Sunday story and I'd work on it all week. And, you know, you would present this thing to the world that was as good as you could get it. And we don't build things like that anymore. We build as we go. And so that's the nature of news. You know, NPR had an interesting little editor's note at the bottom of one of their first Orlando stories that said, this story is going to change, and we're probably going to find that some of the things that we're reporting are wrong. And we're doing our best to keep you updated as we go. So my editor wrote a piece about it, and then we found out later this wasn't actually a new practice for NPR. They've done it before. They tend to do it with, you know, their live blogs as they're updating stories. So I think it's a fair concern. I also think it's appropriate for news organizations and for journalists to be transparent about that, that this is changing as it goes, and we're going to do our best to give you a sense of that.
We've been talking to Christian Hare, the media writer for the Poynter Institute. She writes great stuff, but I expect you to go to that site and read her story on Orlando and how the Orlando Sentinel covered the shooting at Pulse. Also, I note from reading her biography that, or a little snippet on the bottom of her story that she did many years in journalism, but also was a Peace Corps volunteer in Guyana, South America.
Yeah, I was.
What town?
So I lived in Adventure, which was a fantastic name of a town for a 22-year-old, you know, American. Right. My school was in Johanna Sicilia on the Essequibo Coast.
I spent a few, about a month down there years ago in another life.
Did you really?
Yeah, in another life. I was a merchant.
So you know the rum is A+.
The rum is A+. The people are A+.
Yes.
It was poverty, clearly, but the fishing's not bad in the river either.
It's a great place. I actually married a Guyanese man that I met in my village, and we've been married for 13 years this summer and go back there regularly. And so I have a steady supply of El Dorado rum.
There you go. Thanks so much for being with us, Kristen. And everybody, please.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you.